He's really doing the most he can right now, Pamela said. Somehow, I feel like we're twins. There's been almost nothing he's explained that I haven't felt I could extrapolate from my own experience. I'm a fiction writer, and he is also a fiction writer in his way. He creates other worlds. At times he's lived in other worlds. There are characters, there are planets. He has a great aesthetic sense, and that infuses his delusions. It's a very dangerous, scary, lonely world, but it also has moments of beauty in it. My mom deserves huge credit for just never giving up. My stepfather couldn't stay in there fighting. It was too painful for him, but it brought out the warrior in my mother. It's my mother, the doctors, and most of all, Harry. He turns out to have a lot of grit. He's a hero to me. He's someone who's been in Vietnam for 15 years. He still gets up and finds things to be joyful about. Would I have the stomach for the life he has? I'm not sure I would. Kitty led long stretches of a charmed life before Harry got sick. I was a lot more frivolous before I was dragged, kicking and screaming, into the world of mental illness, she said. Now I'm always helping people out, or offering advice, or finding them doctors. I'm sure it's been character building, but frankly, I preferred being happy and frivolous. She knows that Harry feels guilty about the effect he's had on her life, so she tries to minimize it. I asked her how much of her time and emotional energy Harry occupied, and her eyes filled with tears. She shrugged and forced a smile. All of it. All of it, she said, almost guiltily. I can't help it. Schizophrenia is broadly categorized as having positive symptoms, the presence of psychotic hallucinations, and negative and cognitive symptoms, psychic disorganization, absence of motivation, blunted affect, loss of language, called alogia, withdrawal, compromised memory, and general decrease in functionality. One expert described it to me as autism plus delusions, which is an inadequate but not unilluminating description. Here is a patient's description of her positive symptoms. I could find no rest, for horrible images assailed me, so vivid that I experienced actual physical sensation. I cannot say that I really saw images. They did not represent anything. Rather, I felt them. It seemed that my mouth was full of birds, which I crunched between my teeth, and their feathers, their blood, and broken bones were choking me. Or I saw people whom I had entombed in milk bottles, putrefying, and I was consuming their rotten cadavers. Or I was devouring the head of a cat, which meanwhile gnawed at my vitals. It was ghastly, intolerable. Here, by contrast, is another patient describing the experience of the negative and cognitive symptoms. I am all the time losing my emotional contact with everything, including myself. What remains is only an abstract knowledge of what goes on around me and of the internal happenings in myself. Even this illness, which pierces to the center of my whole life, I can regard only objectively. I cannot picture anything more frightful than for a well-endowed, cultivated human being to live through his own gradual deterioration, fully aware of it all the time. But that is what is happening to me. The Nobel laureate Eric Kandel described how schizophrenia takes away the wanting of enjoyment. Imagine someone who has a great time whenever he goes out to dinner, but who has absolutely no interest in doing it, he said. The pleasure principle says that we will always seek gratification and avoid suffering. But for people with schizophrenia, at least half of this is untrue. Emily Dickinson described such a descent into psychosis with terrifying clarity. I felt a cleaving in my mind, as if my brain had split. I tried to match it seam by seam, but could not make it fit. The thought behind I strove to join unto the thought before, but sequence raveled out of sound, like balls upon a floor. Though most people experience schizophrenia as just such a sudden cleaving, it appears in fact to be a developmental disorder that is inscribed in the brain even before birth. It is degenerative, unlike autism, which, albeit pervasive and persistent, does not generally become increasingly debilitating over time. There is a rare syndrome of schizophrenia in pre-adolescence and childhood. The usual course for the condition, however, is that it unfolds through five predictable stages. It is asymptomatic until puberty in the premorbid phase, though recent research points to delays in walking and talking, more isolated play, poor school performance, social anxiety, and poor verbal short-term memory. This is followed by a prodromal phase, which lasts for 4 years on average, in which positive symptoms begin gradually to appear. The adolescent or young adult in this phase experiences changes in cognition, perception, volition, and motor functions, has strange thoughts flash across his mind, struggles to understand whether illogical beliefs are true, and becomes suspicious and wary. Some people who will develop schizophrenia seem curiously detached from the real world even in childhood, and gradually slip into psychosis. Most appear to have a dramatic break, sometimes in reaction to trauma, and sometimes with no obvious trigger, in which they are suddenly transformed beyond recognition. This marks entry into the psychotic phase, with the onset of hallucinations or bizarre delusions, including delusions of control, thought insertion, thought broadcasting, and thought withdrawal. This usually occurs between ages 15 and 30, and lasts for about 2 years. No one has been able to discover what maturational event triggers psychosis. There are three primary possibilities. One is that the teenage rush of hormones changes gene expression in the brain. The second is that myelination, the adolescent process in which the brain wraps neuronal cables in a sheath so that they become maximally functional, goes wrong. The third is that synaptic elimination, or pruning, malfunctions. During normal brain development in infancy, new cells migrate within the brain, position themselves, and establish synaptic connections. An excess of these connections is made. During adolescence, only those that have been strengthened through repetition, that appear useful in the particular person, become enduring neural structures. An unhealthy brain may prune too much, not enough, or in the wrong places. After somebody becomes ill, further changes occur in the progressive phase, which leads to clinical deterioration, except when effectively controlled with medication. As the patient has repeated psychotic episodes, the condition worsens, finding its level after 5 years or so, and settling into the chronic and residual phase. By this time, there has been an irrecoverable loss of gray matter in the brain. Positive symptoms tend to fade somewhat, while negative ones become more pronounced. Patients remain disabled and persistently symptomatic. While more than 80% of patients respond well to antipsychotics during a first episode, only half of those treated at this stage show a comparable response. When Janice Lieber was born in 1953, her mother, Connie, had preeclampsia, a potentially fatal rise in maternal blood pressure, and the birth was rough. Janice seemed disengaged from the start. Connie thought she might be autistic. The pediatrician said she was mentally retarded. As it became clear that she was gifted at mathematics, the autism diagnosis stuck. At 22, she had a psychotic break during her final year of college. Her father, Steve, brought her home. When she got there, she threw everything she loved out the window because a voice told her to do so. Connie called her doctor, who prescribed Melaril, an early antipsychotic, for the weekend. Monday, Janice saw a psychiatrist and received a diagnosis. Connie decided to learn all about schizophrenia, but not much information was out there. Then she and Steve went to Columbia for a meeting on schizophrenia and heard about NARSAD, the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression. NARSAD had at that time raised a total of $50,000 to support scientific investigation. Connie soon became president, a post she held for nearly 20 years. When she stepped down, Steve, who runs an investment fund, took over as chairman. The Liebers built NARSAD into the world's largest private funder of psychiatric and brain research. By 2011, it had given more than 3,000 grants, totaling almost $300 million, to scientists in 31 countries. The Liebers personally review over 1,000 research applications every year. They focus on original proposals by young researchers who cannot secure other funds. Herbert Pardes, president of New York Presbyterian Hospital, said, "Most Nobel Prize winners could learn science from the Liebers." Connie and Steve were messianically busy with NARSAD. One of Janice's psychiatrists asked her if she minded her parents being so occupied, and Janice said, "I don't see my mother as much as I'd like, but I know what she's doing. She's giving of herself for me and others, for mankind." Steve felt that their dedication affirmed for Janice how central she was in their lives, while also relieving some of the pressure that goes along with being an ill child. She was the emblem of the challenge, and that was healthier than being the entire challenge herself, he said. When they began, the Liebers thought it would take 10 years to reach a scientific breakthrough that could change their daughter's life. As this did not occur, they wanted to help Janice directly, and in 2007, they opened the Lieber Clinic at Columbia, which provides rehabilitative services. Janice goes to a day program there that teaches interpersonal sensitivity and other practical skills to people with schizophrenia. She has done remarkably well given the ongoing psychosis she faces, and now lives independently. Connie has advised thousands of parents. "My name was on a lot of materials," she said, "and we never had an unlisted phone number. I don't believe in that. Anyone could find us, and if I could help them, I would." She smiled. "Some people take advantage, but I listen to them." Schizophrenia, like autism, is a blanket term. Eugen Bleuler, who coined the word in 1908, actually referred to schizophrenias. In 1972, the eminent neurologist Frederick Plum famously said, "Schizophrenia is the graveyard of neuropathologists," meaning that no one had understood or would understand its etiology. We now understand more of schizophrenia than we do of autism. It is unclear whether schizophrenia should be subtyped according to biology, genotype, or behavior, phenotype. Despite the variety of genotypes and phenotypes for schizophrenia, no particular form or course of the disease has been linked to a particular set of genetic markers. Some people without the gene defects have the illness, and some people with these mutations do not. They are markers for vulnerability, rather than guarantees of disease. One member of a family with a defective gene can be schizophrenic, but another member with the same gene defect might be bipolar or severely depressed. Schizophrenia clearly runs in families. The most reliable predictor of developing the condition is having a first-degree relative who has it. But most who develop schizophrenia don't have such a relative. Fact 1. Most schizophrenics do not have a schizophrenic parent, Deborah Levy, a practicing psychologist and a professor at Harvard, said. Fact 2. The incidence of schizophrenia is not decreasing, and in some places it is actually increasing. Fact 3. Schizophrenics have a very low reproductive rate. So how do we account for the persistence of the genes that give rise to it? One possible explanation is that most carriers and transmitters of schizophrenia genes are not schizophrenic. Identical twins show only a slightly higher than 50% concordance rate. The shared vulnerability is enormous, but the consequences of that vulnerability are by no means predestined. The children of the well twin and those of the ill twin are at the same escalated risk for the disease. So a person can have the susceptibility genes, not express them as schizophrenia, then transmit them to his or her children, who may develop schizophrenia. No one knows what protects some gene carriers from the condition. One mechanism of psychosis is an imbalance in neurotransmitters, particularly dopamine. Schizophrenic brains show reduced volume in the frontal cortex and hippocampus and dysregulation of the striatum. Genetics most likely mix with environment to cause a shift in biochemistry, which then has a degenerative effect on brain structures. New work suggests that a genetic vulnerability may be activated by a parasite. Everyone has a blueprint of 30,000 or so genes, but the way those are expressed depends on the way the chromosomes are configured and on how external processes suppress or enable gene expression. A great deal of biochemistry determines when, how, whether, and to what extent a gene will be activated. And schizophrenia genes may go unexpressed, while protective genes may be overexpressed. As in autism, instead of a single genetic anomaly accounting for a large proportion of cases, a multiplicity of so-called private mutations, many copy number variations, may each be sufficient to cause the illness. These occur more often in offspring of older parents, especially older fathers. Another mechanism is spontaneous genetic mutation, the same process responsible for most occurrences of Down syndrome. It is now emerging that some spontaneous gene defects, be they changes in copy number or single gene mutations, are found in schizophrenia, autism, and bipolar disorder. Is mental illness on a single spectrum rather than a set of discrete disease entities? I'd say it's more like a grid, said John Crystal, chairman of Yale's Department of Psychiatry and editor of the preeminent journal Biological Psychiatry. The best way to determine what the gene defects are actually doing is to insert them artificially into the genomes of lab mice. The animals are observed to see if they mimic aspects of the illness in humans. Then researchers try to understand how the gene is affecting brain development. Of course, we have no way to tell if mice are hallucinating. Some such transgenic mice, however, become reclusive, hyper-aggressive, or asocial. Some refuse to affiliate with animals of the opposite gender, or recoil from strangers. Many refuse to do work rewarded with food, giving up on tasks that normal mice will gamely pursue. A startlingly good approximation of the demotivation of schizophrenic people. Eric Kandel, who conceived and is designing some of these vast research protocols, has come to what he calls a paradigm shift for schizophrenia. Many illnesses arise from the way a gene expresses itself ongoing. Turn off the gene and the symptoms vanish. Schizophrenia may originate in genes, but turning them off will not mitigate the illness. Once it's in play, it must play itself out. In 2011, I was privy to a conversation between a biotech executive and James Watson, the Nobel laureate who, with Francis Crick, discovered the structure of DNA, and who has a son with schizophrenia. The executive opined that schizophrenia research was diffuse and chaotic. He had a grand scheme for getting everyone to collaborate, so people could each benefit from the knowledge of others. He had hoped he could inspire a breakthrough if he raised $400 million to address the problem. Watson said, "We're nowhere near the stage where collaboration is useful. We don't know enough. There's nothing anyone has figured out for anyone else to build on. We need an insight, not a refinement. If I had your $400 million, I'd find 100 bright young scientists and give each of them $4 million. If I chose right, one of them would come up with something." Every family member of a person with schizophrenia whom I met was scared by these genetic vagaries. One man told me that his girlfriend had refused to marry him because his schizophrenic brother represented a risk to his future children. The history of schizophrenia is the history of blame, Mary Ellen Walsh has written in her guidebook for families and friends of people with the condition. Mothers have borne the brunt of such blame. Freud never suggested that early trauma engenders schizophrenia and did not advocate psychoanalysis for psychotic disorders. The poisonous term schizophrenogenic mother was put forward by the Freudian analyst Frieda Fromm Reichmann in 1948. In her wake came theories of schizophrenia in which the entire family was to blame. One author wrote, "The patient's function is similar to that of an unsuccessful mediator of the emotional differences between the parents." Another, Gregory Bateson, said that schizophrenia is likely to occur for a child whose mother becomes anxious and withdraws if the child responds to her as a loving mother. Such thinking was an antecedent to systems-oriented family therapy, based on the idea that the psychopathology of an entire family was manifested in a single individual as psychosis. Thomas Insull, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, said that the most notable progress since the 1950s has been the end of the blame and shame game. But in my experience of people dealing with schizophrenia, both blame and shame remain highly operative. In 1996, 2 decades after the family systems theory had slipped out of vogue in professional circles, a national survey found that 57% of respondents still believed that schizophrenia was caused by parental behavior. An epidemic of self-help books such as the runaway bestseller, The Secret, argue that mental health is simply a matter of positive thinking. William James called earlier versions of this philosophy, written into Christian Science and other American metaphysical movements of the 19th century, the religion of the healthy-minded, celebrating the conquering efficacy of courage, hope, and trust, and a correlative contempt for doubt, fear, worry. This concept is popular for its suggestion that healthy people have earned their health through personal courage. For those who are unwell, however, the suggestion that flawed discipline and weak character are the source of their psychosis is torture. When mothers internalize blame, it interferes with the very support that people with schizophrenia most need. I sometimes feel as though I wore a scarlet letter S emblazoned upon my chest, wrote the bioethicist Patricia Backlar, who has a schizophrenic son. That S might stand for schizophrenogenic, but is as likely to impute personal shame. Another mother wrote, "An entire generation of mental health professionals was educated to believe that families cause schizophrenia. Some are still treating our sons and daughters and still mistreating us. The psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey, founder of the Treatment Advocacy Center, finds the blame problem absurd. Any parent who has raised a child knows that parents are not powerful enough to cause a disease like schizophrenia simply by favoring one child over another, or giving the child inconsistent messages, he wrote. When the doctors at Long Island Jewish Hospital wanted to recruit Philip and Bobby Smithers for a genetic study of schizophrenia in the 1990s, their mother fought to keep them out of it. "What's in it for us?" she asked. In the first decade of the new millennium, Philip, Bobby, and their unaffected older brother Paul were in their 30s, and Paul's wife, Frida, wanted to know how vulnerable her children might be. As Frida began investigating the extended family, she found illness everywhere. Paul's aunt had been institutionalized her entire adult life with postpartum depression. An uncle was sick in the head, and many quirky cousins could barely function. Although Paul and Frida were high school sweethearts, Frida had met Paul's father only once before their marriage, because Paul kept everyone away from him. "You'd think that when Paul's brothers both started acting strange," Frida said, "their mother would have told the doctor that there's a family history of schizophrenia. But that's not the way they do it, so it took years for them to be diagnosed." Secrecy is a difficult habit to break. "Every year, we have a Thanksgiving for Frida's family, and then we have one for mine," Paul said. "If we mix the two, I'm defensive, my mom is defensive of my brothers, and it's upsetting to Frida's family to see these sick people. I don't discuss this with even my closest friends. I'm not in denial, like the rest of my family. I just don't like talking about it. I have an emotional connection with my brothers. I think about them every day. But do I have a relationship with them? Not really. They're very highly medicated." Paul and Frida, who now have two sons, live in terror of seeing them develop schizophrenia. They considered using a sperm donor, but couldn't bring themselves to do so. "We're making genetic rolls of the dice," Paul said. Frida described her fear as a constant mental drain. She added, "We torture them in some ways. I read an article saying that people who develop schizophrenia have particular traits. We strip them naked. We're going through their whole bodies looking for webbed toes. Someone said more schizophrenics are born in the winter, so we timed it to have summer babies. Nutty, I know. In some ways, it's very liberating. Everyone wants their kids to be the smartest and the most athletic. We really don't care, as long as they're healthy." In 2008, Paul and Frida agreed to participate in a survey on schizophrenia genetics. "We sit by the phone," Frida said, "waiting to find out what the gene is, so we can test the kids." In 1668, John Bunyan wrote, "Let them recover one to his wits that was mad, and he that can do thus shall have the name and fame he desires. He may lay abed till noon." There was little progress between Bunyan's times and modernity. For centuries, treatments for schizophrenia were ineffectual, barbaric, or both. In the 19th century, they included pulling teeth. In the middle years of the 20th, they included lobotomy. The development of antipsychotic medications, beginning with Thorazine in 1950, has been a miraculous breakthrough in treating schizophrenia's positive symptoms. Unfortunately, these medications have negligible effects on negative symptoms. As Helen Mayberg, chair of neuroimaging at Emory, said, "It's as though you've got a house that's burning down. You come in with the fire trucks and pump the place full of water. You put out the conflagration. It's still charred, smoke-damaged, flooded, structurally unstable, and pretty much uninhabitable, even if flames are no longer licking the walls. The damage done by the disease persists, and the techniques for mitigating that damage constitute their own ordeal. Thorazine flattens personalities much as lobotomy did, and while newer medications are somewhat better, the number of people with schizophrenia who go off their medication indicates how detested they are by the patients who must take them. In the 1970s, the Soviets administered antipsychotics for torture and subjugation and were able to induce symptoms of psychological disability with them. One loses his individuality, his mind is dulled, his emotions destroyed, his memory lost as a result of the treatment. All the subtle distinctiveness of a person is wiped away, said one survivor of such treatment at a Senate hearing on Soviet abuses of psychopharmacology. Although I am afraid of death, let them shoot me rather than this. A patient named Janet Gotkin described her contemporaneous treatment in the American psychiatric system in similar terms. I became alienated from myself, my thoughts, my life, a prisoner of drugs and psychiatric mystification. My body, heavy as a bear's, lumbered and lurched as I tried to maneuver the curves of my outside world. These drugs are used not to heal or help, but to torture and control. Another patient said, "The muscles of your jawbone go berserk, so that you bite the inside of your mouth, and your jaw locks, and the pain throbs. Your spinal column stiffens so that you can hardly move your head or your neck, and sometimes your back bends like a bow, and you cannot stand up. The pain grinds into your fiber. You ache with restlessness, so you feel you have to walk, to pace. Then as soon as you start pacing, the opposite occurs to you. You must sit and rest." These accounts relate to older antipsychotics and neuroleptics, but the side effects of modern medications differ more in degree than in nature. By the time I began to meet members of his family, Malcolm Pease was dead at 52, but it was not yet clear why he had died. The previous 12 years had been the best of his adult life. Then one day, a nurse at his group home found him curled up in what looked like a comfortable position, cold and dead. He was very overweight, his brother Doug said, largely from the medication. He had a lifetime of heavy smoking behind him. Because he was young, there were police. Pretty much on the spot, they ruled out suicide. Of 17 children in Malcolm's generation, siblings and cousins, 4 have severe mental illness. Many prefer not to discuss it, a position for which Penny Pease, Malcolm's mother, 85 when he died, has disdain. "I talk about it all the time, with a lot of people," she said. In high school, Malcolm had no meaningful signs of illness. "He was a really good athlete," Penny recalled. "He was a fantastic bridge player, and cribbage, and oh boy was he competitive. He loved skiing. He loved everything. We had no clue." During his freshman year at Franklin Pierce in the winter of 1975, he began hearing voices and developing paranoid fantasies. In March, his roommate called to tell the Pisas that something was horribly wrong, and Malcolm's parents brought him home. "We knew he was in trouble," Penny said. "He wasn't making much sense." His brother Doug said, "He was completely out of control, didn't know why, and we didn't either." The following November, Malcolm assaulted his father. "My parents sent him to the Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut, which was among the better private mental hospitals," Doug said. "It was captivity, really. They were feeding him sedatives. Your brother is a ghost in his former body, whom you can't reach because he's so dulled down. The other patients look like Night of the Living Dead." Malcolm soon signed himself out against advice, and his parents initiated a proceeding to have him committed. Over the years, he had to be recommitted dozens of times. When he was not hospitalized, Malcolm lived with his parents. "My parents tried to love him back to health," said Malcolm's other brother, Peter. But Malcolm wouldn't stay on his medication. Their sister, Polly, said, "Once he was feeling normal, he would think, 'I don't need to take these anymore.' Then you crash and burn again, and again, and again. When he wasn't taking his drugs, he would become paranoid. Everybody who came near, he would think, 'Oh, you're just trying to put me in the hospital and force me to take antipsychotics,'" Peter said. Of course, he was right. Everyone tried to keep up as much normality as possible. "All you can do is tell him what reality is, in a loving way," Doug said. Polly remembered, "Some of it was just funny. I remember he asked my mother where she was when Martin Luther King was shot, and whether she could prove she didn't do it." Sometimes poetry crept in, too. When asked at one of his admissions what he was thinking, he said, "I do not like sex or French kissing. There is gas outside of the Indian Ocean, and there are diamonds up in the North Pole." Despite the madness, he sustained a central coherence. "He didn't disappear," Penny said. "He still liked animals and playing cards. He missed the friends he'd had before he became sick." Polly said, "The thing that made him himself was always there. It just wasn't where you could find it all the time." The hospitalizations became increasingly frequent. The ongoing discussion year after year was, "You have to stay on medication," and Malcolm refused, Doug said. Off the meds, he felt freer, more alive, sort of high, also mostly distraught. "Would you rather be awakened alive or a walking zombie?" He would try to find the sweet spot in the middle. When Malcolm's father developed cancer, Peter decided that it was time to step in. "I carried the essence of who Malcolm was with me, and never let who he became take that over," Peter said. One of the first antipsychotics, clozapine, had been taken off the market in 1975 because it can reduce the concentration of white blood cells, a condition called agranulocytosis. Researchers eventually realized that clozapine was the most effective treatment for schizophrenia, and that for many patients, its efficacy outweighed the side effect risk. Malcolm started on clozapine when it returned to the market in 1990. Peter said, "There was always enough of who he really was for me to love, but sometimes it got squeezed rather mightily. Then with clozapine it came back, the smile, the laugh, the sense of humor. If you know who somebody is, you can lead them back to themselves." In his human relationships, Malcolm remained deeply caring. "He was always just worried about everyone else," Polly said. Doug expressed enormous sympathy for Malcolm's reality. "He always felt he had wronged people along the way. We found a letter dated 2002 from his original doctor. 30 years later, it says, 'Dear Malcolm, to the best of my knowledge, no, you never hurt anyone. Hope you are well. Sincerely, Dr. Koff.'" Penny said, "He never changed that way. I never loved him less because he was sick. I never loved him more. I never even loved him differently." At 39, Malcolm graduated to a supported home in Framingham and got a job bagging groceries at the Stop and Shop. "That's what he could handle, and it was awesome," Doug said. "We were dancing in the streets." Malcolm had done well on the clozapine for about 5 years, and then it all began to come apart again. "He was always tinkering with his medication," Doug said. "He had to be hospitalized again. I was in the hospital to visit him, and the doctor says, 'Well, Malcolm is heading home now. He'll be just fine. So I take him back to Framingham. He makes a suicide attempt that evening, ingesting laundry detergent. Malcolm was rushed back to the hospital. It's ridiculous to try to commit suicide by eating Tide, Peter said. The imagery, though, is interesting. I'm going to wash this disease right out of my body. Polly's first husband and Peter's first wife had been afraid of and intolerant of Malcolm, and it had created tensions in those marriages, both of which ultimately dissolved. However, all of Malcolm's nieces and nephews loved him. He's just his own particular strong essence, Peter said. There was no other weirdness going on than his being crazy. When he was well, we had great times. Malcolm's years in Framingham were relatively happy. He had refused to drive for decades, but after he went on clozapine, that changed, and Peter bought him a Ford Ranger. That was one of the best days of my whole life, to see him driving out of that dealership with this huge smile on his face, Peter said. Malcolm was beloved at the Framingham house. One of the other residents told Peter, every morning, Malcolm would come down to the common room and say, Maurice, where can I take you today? Peter said, part of his ministry was driving people in his red truck, like a taxi service. No one expected Malcolm to die when he did. Peter said, of course, the illness reduces your life expectancy, and the medication, even though it's helping you, reduces your life expectancy too. But at least he got himself to the best place he could. We'll take this death because of the quality of life he had. Malcolm had been part of a McLean study on the genetics of schizophrenia. After he died, researchers there said they'd like his brain to study. Penny endorsed the idea. Doug enjoys repeating his comment at the memorial service. Malcolm didn't complete college because of his illness, but he finally got into Harvard, and he's teaching the neuroscientists. The coroner's office took blood samples, just to rule out the possibility of wrongdoing. A few months later, the family learned that clozapine ended the same life it had redeemed. We didn't realize death by clozapine was even possible, but are gradually learning more about it, Peter wrote to me. It seems that toxic levels of clozapine built up over time because his liver was not processing it. Some have suggested to us that liver function should be tested regularly to make sure there is not a buildup in toxicity and that this is a matter of standard practice. So it is probably a malpractice issue, which we won't pursue. At high levels, apparently, clozapine can cause heart arrhythmia and coma respiratory arrest. Now we are left with the final tragedy. The medications we forced him to take, which he railed against and fought with all his spirit for most of his life, killed him. It is probably good that we did not know the cause of his death before we celebrated his life and had the memorial service. This news beats us down, and it is very hard to rise up singing. The liberation movements of the 1960s questioned the very concept of mental illness. Michel Foucault mounted a systematic assault on the idea that insanity was anything more than a power play by self-declared sane people. Irving Goffman maintained that mental hospitals made people crazy. R.D. Lang said, there is no such condition as schizophrenia, but the label is a social fact and political event. Spoke of schizophrenia as a special strategy that a person invents in order to live in an unlivable situation, and maintained, madness need not be all breakdown. It may also be breakthrough. It is potentially liberation and renewal, as well as enslavement and existential death. Thomas Szasz emerged as the great apologist for the idea that schizophrenia is always a fiction. The last generation has witnessed a great social experiment called deinstitutionalization, which has removed people with acute mental illnesses from large state institutions, reducing the number of schizophrenics in long-term custodial care in the United States from more than 500,000 in 1950 to some 40,000 today. This movement draws on a curious mix of valid optimism, economic expediency, and ideological rigidity. While previous treatment of schizophrenics was inhumane, current treatment is often negligible. Money and personnel were never shifted to the community facilities that were supposed to provide services after the institutions were closed. Federal guidelines are incredibly vague, and oversight is virtually non-existent. The vision of treatment as a mechanism of social control infuriates people who are trying to advance encompassing treatment policies. E. Fuller Torrey, perhaps the most prominent critic of the social realities around schizophrenia, has said, "Freedom to be insane is an illusory freedom, a cruel hoax perpetrated on those who cannot think clearly by those who will not think clearly." Judge Beryl Caesar wrote bitingly in 1990, "The right to treatment has become the right to no treatment, with the result that we have consigned many persons to lives of quiet desperation, have destroyed the mental and emotional health of those who love and care for them, and have destroyed families to the ultimate detriment and even destruction of the disabled person." The therapist Anne Braden Johnson, author of Out of Bedlam, The Truth About Deinstitutionalization, complains of the myth that mental illness is a myth, and argues that deinstitutionalization was the result of a politics that emerged as ideas about deviance changed, which was in turn the result of the emergence of biological psychiatry, which made it logical to spend mental health dollars on something other than custodial care. Near-universal institutionalization was ruinous, but near-universal deinstitutionalization is equally bad. The schizophrenia researcher Nancy Andreasen points out that state hospitals were small communities unto themselves, where patients lived together as a family, and were given a chance to be productively employed by the hospital farm, kitchen, or laundry. One of the new system's fallacies is its ambition to order. The patients I see don't fit readily into most existing programs, and programs they might fit in simply don't exist, Johnson wrote. Bureaucrats who drew up programs often have never seen a patient, much less treated one. A vacuum of empathy exists in any system that returns people who don't know how to be in a community to communities that may not be prepared to handle them. The lack of support and erratic access to medication often result in rapid deterioration. But family members who attempt to arrest that are frustrated by the courts. The elderly father of one schizophrenic said, "The authorities say it is their choice and their right to live like stray animals." Why is rapid suicide illegal and gradual suicide a right? When Madeleine Grammont's brother, William, began to act erratically, their father refused to acknowledge what was going on. William had earned a perfect score on his math SATs and had been admitted to Harvard as a sophomore. By the end of his junior year, he had to leave. "My father was mortified," Madeleine said. William went up to his family's country place in New Hampshire. "He was subsisting on raw garlic and had knives sitting everywhere," Madeleine said. "He was sleeping on the floor. My father found a small house for him in the woods, away from the summer community, so no one would see him. In fact, my father saw him only 3 times in 30 years. Once a week, William walked down to the town general store. usually clothed in just a towel, talking to himself. Local teenagers would taunt him. His father maintained that he was just a touch eccentric, but his sister worried, and as their domineering father grew feeble in old age, she went up to see William. "Mice and rat turds everywhere. Mayonnaise jars opened and rotting," she said. "Broken dishes everywhere. His bedroom was truly disgusting. He looked at me curiously, but he had lost his language. He made little squeaking sounds, and that was it." So Madeline took over the case. She sought legal guardianship, obtained a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and brought him to a residential care center. There he began using rudimentary speech again. "I brought him flowers once, some lilies, and he leaned over and smelled them," she said. "I brought them every single time thereafter, and I still do. I take him out every 2 or 3 weeks. He can't initiate conversation, and he talks very little, but he seems increasingly able to understand. He basically saw his first treatment at age 52. That kind of denial, the way my father was, it ate him alive. And now he's just a hollow wreck, a whole life slipped away that didn't have to." The brain is composed of gray matter, made of cell bodies, white matter, the axons that connect the cell bodies and create synapses, and ventricles, fluid-containing spaces that allow for circulation of the cerebrospinal fluid. When you lose brain tissue, you have bigger ventricles, and a cardinal feature of schizophrenia is enlargement of the lateral ventricles. While autism is characterized by an overabundance of synaptic connectivity, schizophrenia is marked by a dearth of it. People with schizophrenia also have fewer dendritic spines, which form synapses, and fewer interneurons, a type of brain cell that regulates mental activity. The positive symptoms of schizophrenia appear to be tied to abnormalities in the temporal lobe, where auditory and emotional perception are located. The negative symptoms appear to be tied to damage to the frontal and prefrontal lobes, where cognition and attention are based. Genetic vulnerability to schizophrenia is subject to precipitating traumas, including variations in the uterine environment. Obstetrical, labor, and delivery complications are bad for a developing fetal brain, and schizophrenia patients are more likely to have a history of them. Maternal infections, such as rubella and influenza during pregnancy, also increase risk. The high rate of winter births of people who develop schizophrenia is probably linked to increased second trimester maternal viral infections. Stressful events during pregnancy have been correlated with schizophrenia. The rate is higher, for example, for children of women who lived through a military invasion while carrying, or whose spouses died during their pregnancies. Famine in Holland during World War II led to a dramatic increase in the incidence of schizophrenia 20 years later. Scientists have proposed that prenatal stress results in the release of hormones that disturb fetal neurodevelopment. Stress can activate the mother's dopamine system, and that may dysregulate the fetuses. Postnatal events, such as head trauma in early childhood, increase the risk of developing schizophrenia. Lifetime stress plays a role too. The risk is particularly high among immigrants who go from underdeveloped settings to cities, people confronting exponential unfamiliarity. The most consistent post-uterine environmental factor associated with the worsening of psychotic symptoms is the abuse of recreational drugs, including alcohol, methamphetamines, hallucinogens, cocaine, and marijuana, particularly in adolescence. When the Japanese gave methamphetamines to workers to increase productivity during the post-war recovery, they provoked epidemic levels of psychosis. Although many people recovered after they stopped using the drugs, others had transient recurrence, and some had prolonged and even permanent impairment. A seminal study done in the 1980s with some 50,000 Swedish conscripts showed that those who had used marijuana more than 50 times were 6 times more likely to develop schizophrenia. The relationship between drug abuse and psychosis is perhaps like that between smoking and lung cancer, said Cyril D'Souza, a psychiatrist at Yale. It's a contributing, not a necessary cause. But some studies suggest that if you were able to eliminate cannabis, you could reduce world rates of schizophrenia by at least 10%. In schizophrenia, some gene-environment combination causes the neurotransmitters dopamine, glutamate, norepinephrine, serotonin, and GABA to become dysregulated, leading to excess activity in one dopamine pathway. This induces psychosis and other positive symptoms. Artificially releasing too much dopamine can provoke the symptoms of schizophrenia even in healthy subjects. Suppressing it can mitigate those symptoms. Underactivity in another dopamine pathway creates impaired cognition and other negative symptoms. Antipsychotic medications block the ability of the brain to process high levels of neurotransmitters in some areas. They mimic controlled levels of those neurotransmitters in others. All successful antipsychotics lower dopamine levels. But lowering dopamine is not by itself enough consistently to remit all of the symptoms of schizophrenia. And new research focuses on drugs that will affect particular receptors for glutamate and other transmitters. Anissa Abidaram at Columbia University is delineating which dopamine receptors are overstimulated and which are understimulated to map ever more specific goals for medications. Non-chemical interventions can play a meaningful secondary role. Talk therapies can help in the management of symptoms that do not respond to medication. Though cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which teaches people to redirect their present thoughts and behaviors, has the strongest track record, many other talk therapies have powerful exponents. And the law professor Ellen Sachs has written movingly of her redeeming experiences with psychoanalysis in her battle with schizophrenia. What you do with your brain changes it. And if you can get someone with schizophrenia into a rational mode for some time, the positive effects are substantive. The theory is that much as someone who loses speech in a stroke can relearn talking through speech therapy, someone with psychosis may be able to train his way partially out of it. Since the disease is associated with a progressive loss of gray matter in the brain, it makes sense that if you identify people quickly, treat them, and keep them well, you can limit the morbidity of the illness and prevent people from becoming irreversibly impaired. The therapeutic nihilism that pervaded the field for the better part of the 20th century is really no longer warranted, said Jeffrey Lieberman, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia and director of the New York State Psychiatric Institute. There is no better time in the history of mankind to have a mental illness than now, as long as you know where and how to obtain good treatment fast. As with autism, early detection and intervention may be key, an idea that has now engendered an international early psychosis association. Early behavioral intervention in autism can diminish the expression of symptoms. The training seems to affect the brain's actual development. Early intervention may be equally promising in schizophrenia, even if early means age 18 years rather than age 18 months. Thomas McGlashan, a professor of psychiatry at Yale, has proposed that earlier diagnosis and medication during someone's first dip into psychosis may actually truncate the brain degeneration that otherwise characterizes advancing schizophrenia. Given the inadequacy of cures, the increasing focus is on getting in even earlier, on prevention at the prodromal, pre-psychotic, stage. Patients are in what Lieberman calls a Humpty Dumpty situation, in which, with our current tools, it's easier to prevent the morbidity of schizophrenia from